is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's Friday. So Shabbat Shalom and Juma Mubarak and TGIF and Senator Sanders. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us, the guy I think of as America's senator. He is the senior senator from Vermont. No, the junior senator from Vermont. And Senator, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom. I am senior, but I am the junior senator
from Vermont. I was thinking, I think Pat Lay has been there a little longer.
My grandchildren think I'm senior.
There you go. So a lot going on in the...
There's a lot going on.
In Congress.
There's a lot going on, and I hope we can have a good and vigorous discussion today. The first issue is... I think the TPP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that some people may have noticed that yesterday that bill was proposed. They're going to have a hearing on it in the Finance Committee. And what Trans-Pacific Partnership is about is a 12-nation so-called trade agreement, which would be the largest in the history of the United States of America. Corporate America is pushing this very, very hard. Chamber of Commerce is out there. The drug companies are out there. Wall Street is out there. They want it very much. The president, sadly, wants it. The most progressive members of the Congress clearly are in opposition, as I believe are the American people, especially working families. On Thursday, I believe, I was at a wonderful rally sponsored by the United Steelworkers of America. The rally was on Capitol Hill, and Sherrod Brown of Ohio, Elizabeth Warren, Massachusetts, and I, Keith Ellison, a number of the more progressive members of Congress were out there speaking against it to an audience of folks who knew very, very well what unfettered free trade in terms of NAFTA and CAFTA and permanent normal relations with China, what those trade agreements have done to America. And our message was pretty simple. When you have failed trade agreements, when time and time and time again, trade agreements did not do what the proponents said they would do. They said they would create jobs, but in fact, they cost us jobs. They said they would raise wages in America. In fact, they resulted in a race to the bottom and lower wages. Why in God's name would we go forward in a policy that has demonstrably failed? And we'll see what happens. Democrats are split in the House, as I understand it. Most Democrats, a good majority, are against it. Most Republicans are for it. We will see where some of the Tea Party folks, Republicans, come out. In the Senate, I believe it's hard to say. You have a number of folks who have not yet given their position. I know that the AFL-CIO and the unions are lobbying very, very hard against the proposal. They're going to put some TV ads on against senators and congressmen, Democrats who are wavering on the issue. But what is important to understand is that what this agreement does is several things, and what it's about. It's important. First of all, the lack of transparency. We're asked to vote on this, presumably in a couple of weeks after it comes out of committee. And we know very little about what's in it. As a member of the United States Senate, I can walk into the room. There's actually more secrecy involved in this trade agreement than there is in some very sensitive foreign policy issues. Hmm. I can walk into the room. I can read the document, which is heavily legalese, very, very long. I cannot bring a staff member in it. I can't copy any of the information, which makes my going in, unless I have a photographic memory, not that significant. So there is very little transparency. What we know about it, what the public knows about it, has literally been leaked. We do know that the major people involved in it are the multinationals. Organized labor has had a part in some parts of it, but the bulk of the effort and input has come from multinational corporations. That's number one, not any transparency. Number two, what we do know is this trade agreement includes Vietnam, and I was to Vietnam a number of years ago. People there work really, really hard, very poor. minimum wage there a few years ago used to be 25 cents an hour. It's now gone up to 56 cents an hour. So as has been the case in past trade agreements, American workers would be forced to compete against people who make 56 cents an hour. Now, I don't think that that is quote-unquote free trade. I think that's totally absurd. Third part about this dangerous trade agreement is that what it does is allow international tribunals, quasi-judiciary bodies, to make decisions which could override what local, state, and federal governments do in the United States of America. One example, which I think is just unspeakable, which would be, as I understand it, incorporated into this Trans-Pacific Partnership. Listen to this. In Uruguay, which is a very tiny country, the government there is attempting to do the right thing to protect their children and their population from the horrors of tobacco and cigarette addiction. So they have been very aggressive in a public health campaign to significantly label cigarette products and talk about what cigarettes do to you in terms of cancer and heart disease, etc., and mount a major campaign. But what TPP and these trade agreements are based on is that the bottom line is the bottom line, and that is the highest value is the ability of corporations to make profits. So Philip Morris, which is obviously one of the large tobacco companies in the world, sued the government of Uruguay. And you know why they sued him, Tom?
No.
The crime was that Uruguay was impacting the potential profits of Philip Morris, making it harder for them to sell their murderous, if you like, products to the kids of Uruguay. So Philip Morris is saying, look, we could sell our products in Uruguay. You're making it hard. You're costing us a profit. Therefore, you're acting illegally, because the bottom line of all of humanity, of everything we stand for, is not the health of the children, but it's the ability for us to make a profit.
Right.
And then that goes to a tribunal. And then the debate is not whether the government of Uruguay did the right thing, which they did. It's whether they are impeding the profits of Philip Morris. That's insane.
Yeah.
But that's not only for a health issue like cigarettes. It is for environmental issues. State of Vermont, for example, comes up with environmental. Maybe it's anti-fracking. Maybe it's whatever it is. And it says, look, we want to protect the health of the people of Vermont, or California does it. Well, yeah, but you're impeding our ability to make a profit. And God knows that is the most important standard that the world has. Doesn't matter what you do to people, what you do to democracy. What's only important is that we have a corporatist world of whose value is profits for large multinational corporations. Unbelievable.
Well, it's essentially,
that is the heart and soul of what this TPP is about.
And it's essentially sociopathic. I mean, a sociopath is a person who doesn't consider the reality, the feelings of other human beings, just wants to get what they want to get. That's
right.
Kind of this business thing. It's
you know, the Pope Francis has been very strong on these issues. And what he says is so far is that money itself and the accumulation of money is the foundation of everything else, not the health of the children, not the well-being of people. It's, can billionaires make more money? You got a world financial system today where the top 85 wealthiest people own more wealth than the bottom half of the world's population. Oxfam tells us that in a year or two, top 1% of the world's population will own more wealth than the bottom 99%. And these guys are saying, it ain't enough, we need more. And that's to a large degree what TPP is about.
Senator Bernie Sanders here with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour on the Tom Hartman program. We're live, it's Friday, and we'll be taking your calls right after this, 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Senator Sanders' website at sanders.senate.gov. And welcome back. Senator, you want to take some calls?
Let's do it.
Okay. Bill in Danbury, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, Tom, Senator Sanders. My question is, all the proponents of the TPP, have they given any logical, practical reason for all secrecy?
Yes. Their rationale is that it is hard to negotiate an agreement with 11 other countries if everybody knows the information. Other countries will learn about the information. Countries will say this and countries will say that. They'll be demanding changes. At the end of the day, presumably, you have to have an agreement which, word for word, dotted I and cross T, everybody is in agreement. So if there's a vigorous debate in the United States and three lines are changed, they're going to have to go back to 11 other countries who will also have to change the three lines, and on it goes. They'll never have an agreement. That's ostensibly what their argument is. The truth is, I think, is somewhat different, and that is that the more that people know about the agreement, the less support that there will be. And I should mention that in terms of public health, it's not just Philip Morris versus Uruguay and that type of approach. It is Doctors Without Borders, who, Tom, as you know, have been one of the more courageous groups in the world, going to, you know, the poorest places on earth and providing health care for people most in need. They see this trade agreement as a disaster because it gives the pharmaceutical industry, and the drug companies love the agreement, the ability to extend their intellectual property rights for longer periods of time, forcing the people in poor countries to pay higher prices for drugs because they'll be brand name drugs rather than generics, which will mean for people like Doctors Without Borders, making it harder for them to get the drugs they need to save poor people's lives.
Okay. Cynthia in College Station, Texas. Got about a minute and a half, 2 minutes to the break here, Cynthia. Quick question.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Senator Sanders. I was wondering, Senator Sanders, are you aware of CrossCheck, the program where they kick people off for double voting in different states? Chris Kobach, Secretary of State, came up with it. I don't think we can win again if they can always go in and kick off more people. Would you let me know what you think about that?
Sure. Look, Cynthia, the Republican Party is intellectually bankrupt. Their policies are way out of touch with where the American people are. They represent very few people when you look at their policies. The only way they win elections is, A, by supporting concepts like Citizens United, which allows billionaires to buy elections, and, B, doing everything they can to suppress the vote in making it harder in a variety of ways for people to participate in the democratic process. Under the guise of fighting so-called voter fraud, end of quote, what they are doing is say everybody needs to have an ID, and if you don't have a car or an automobile, you don't have enough money to pay for the identification, well, you know what, you may not be able to vote. So that's poor people, that's elderly people excluded from the process. Then you got gerrymandering. So these guys are working day and night to manipulate the electoral system so a whole lot of people can't participate. So we've got to fight them on that every step of the way.
We'll be right back. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. And Shauna, is it Shauna or Shanna in Seattle?
It's Shanna in Seattle.
You are on the air with Senator Sanders, Shanna.
Okay, first off, can I just say thank you to both of you. You show me that besides our bubble out there, there's so many intelligent people in the furthest reaches of the South who are paying attention and they're not fools. And next is beyond the TPP, which is just scary, and how do we stop it, is Senator Sanders, how do we insert progressive into, if now that this Hillary machine is going, he said the other day, no matter who's president, that the people have to move or it doesn't matter, nothing's going to change
right.
Unless people do something. How do we, are people going to fight in the next year and a half, or how do we insert you into that campaign, an independent vice or something like that to take care of business and let her have the limelight? How can we do this?
Yes. Okay, well, Shana, you raise, and, you know, let me be clear, it's more than about me. You raise, I would say, the major, you know, hit the nail on the head in terms of the major political question that we face. These are very, very, very difficult and complicated times in American history. And you can argue that the problems are more serious today than they have been since the Great Depression, and Shana hit on some of them. What you have is a movement in this country, in my view, in terms of economics. What we have seen since 1985 is many trillions of dollars of wealth transferred from the broad middle class to the top one-tenth of 1%. I'm talking about trillions and trillions of dollars. So that median family income today is significantly lower than it was 20 years ago, while the wealthiest people are doing unbelievably well. And then politically, I think what Shana is talking about is you have another machine out there, and as a result of Citizens United, billionaires can spend as much money as they want to elect the candidates who will support their interests. And then you got a corporate media out there who decides what is worthy of being discussed and what is not worthy of being discussed. And the reason that I have been doing this show with Tom for now, how many years, Tom? 7, 8, 9 years?
Yeah, close to a decade. I don't know how long it's been. Yeah.
Is because there are very few voices out there, very few opportunities, and Tom is one of a handful that allows the American people to hear alternative points of view. So what do? And, you know, I think, as Shana implies, I have been giving serious thought to running for president of the United States of America. And I'll make that decision fairly soon. And I can give you 8 hours worth of reasons, and I think many other people can, as to why I should run. And that is that the working families of this country need a voice. The billionaire class has got to be taken on. Climate change is a global crisis which has to be dealt with, et cetera, et cetera. But what I also am trying to do is live in the very real world, and it's not a pretty world, Shana. And that world is that, you know, the billionaire class will put, we don't know. I mean, the estimate is now when Obama ran, he and Mitt Romney both spent a little over $1 billion. That apparently is now chicken feed. And these guys are going to be spending maybe $2 billion, $2 billion just on the presidential election. And most of the money may well come into super PACs. And then you've got a media which is not particularly interested in dealing with real issues. And the question, to my mind, most significantly, are the people of this country really, in a serious way, prepared, which is what Shana is talking about, to really get involved in a grassroots effort to take on the billionaire class? And I was out in Shana's part of the world, not quite that north, California, a couple of weeks ago, tremendous support. Las Vegas, great support. Texas, huge support. But can we mobilize people not for a quote-unquote Bernie Sanders campaign, but for a people's campaign? I would be part of it, obviously. It's my name that would be on the ballot. But can we mobilize? And it's easy for me to give a great speech. Oh, yeah, we could do this. No problem. Well, not so sure. And if we do it, it has to be done well. Not my ego, but for everything that most people who are listening to this program believe in. Because if you run a bad campaign, then your opponents say, see, nobody really cares about the collapse of the American middle class. Nobody cares about income and wealth inequality. Nobody cares that young people can't afford to go to college. Those aren't important issues. Sanders ran on those issues. Look how badly he did. So that's what we're wrestling with. And it is the hardest, to be very honest with you, Shana, it is the hardest political decision I've ever had to make in my life. And I you know, I'm talking to everybody that I can. But that's kind of where we are. We'll make that decision shortly, and I thank you for your support, but it is a tough decision.
We have 20 seconds to the break, Senator.
Okay. You know, I think where we are is that everybody, and Shana quoted me exactly right, no one person is going to change this country, not the best president in the history of the world, because you have so much power in terms of lobbyists and corporate interests around Washington, D.C., that you will need a unprecedented grassroots movement which forces the Congress to do the right thing in terms of the needs of the middle class and working families of this country.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls in our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 28 minutes before the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, live from... Oh, he's not in the chair yet? Is he on his way back? Hopefully. Okay. Here he comes. Senator Sanders will be with us. Hey, Senator.
Good. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you for being with us. Tom, in Bradenton, Florida, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Senator, I used to live in Vermont for 2 years, and I would absolutely love for you to run for president because... I want to make a specific point. I found out I have melanoma. I found out today that they got it all out through surgery. But
good.
I had to go through the federal ACA because of Rick Scott's policies down here. Now, because I've followed Tom's show for a decade, I've listened to you every time you speak. I really think that you have an obligation to run for president because you're so articulate. And you do speak for people like myself who are also articulate, but we're getting shut out. If I had Rick Scott's policy, I'd be dead in 3 years. The surgeon told me that. And I had a pre-existing condition for cancer, so I couldn't get insurance. So just two quick questions, and I'll take the answer off the air, please, sir. Senator, if you did decide to run for president, would you consider asking either Alan Grayson or Al Franken to be your running mate, because I think that would create a tremendous intellectual impact at the debates, and you'd make these people look like fools. And God bless you for your work, both of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Let me follow up with your very last question, Tom. It's a long way off to be selecting vice presidential nominees, but Al Franken is somebody who's been a friend of mine for a long, long time. I think Al is pretty much committed to Hillary Clinton. But you're right in saying that Al is a very powerful mind and has, needless to say, an extraordinary sense of humor. Al's a good friend of mine, but I think he's committed elsewhere. Alan Grayson is somebody who I also know, not as well, and he is a very smart guy, God, and very, very quick on his feet. And Alan Grayson is, in my view, playing a very good role in pushing the progressive agenda. But it's a little bit premature to talk about VP nominees. And Tom, congratulations. I'm delighted to hear that your medical diagnosis is good, that the melanoma seems to have dealt with. Look, what Tom talks about, what's taking place in Florida is taking place all over this country. The media forgot to report it, but the Republican budget that was just passed in the House and the Senate. This is the truth. Nobody argues with it. You don't know it because it wasn't reported. Simple fact. In both the House and the Senate budgets, the Republicans repealed the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. That means 16 million Americans would lose their health insurance. They cut Medicaid by, in the Senate, I know, some $400 billion. Don't know what it is in the House, which would throw another 11 million people off of health insurance. That is 27 million people off of health insurance. And that would be, it put people in a position, and Tom is describing getting diagnosed with melanoma, where they couldn't go to the doctor in many cases to make that diagnosis and certainly couldn't get it treated. So you're killing thousands and thousands of people. It's a simple fact. Throw 27 million people off of health insurance, no doubt that many, many, many thousands of people every year would die who otherwise would not have died. That's what we're up against right now. So, yes, Tom, we've got to fight it as hard as we can in every way, and thank you very much for your support.
Barvo in Dallas, Texas. You're on the air, Senator Sanders. Barvo?
Good. Thank you very much. Senator, I want to tell you that I appreciate you being in the arena. I'm a conservative, probably an ultra-conservative, but I agree with you 100%. How many conservatives like me agree with you that these trade agreements are terrible and will hurt our middle class?
Well, Barbara, you've raised a very... I'll tell you a funny story, which kind of reflects what you're saying. Years and years and years ago, when I was in the House, I was on Fox Television. And I was able to talk about some trade agreement which was taking place then. This is years before TPP. And when I got back to my office, there were dozens and dozens and dozens of phone calls and everything else where people said, Sanders, we think you're terrible. We think you're awful. But you know what? You're right on this trade agreement. The truth is, this is a funny story, Tom, that there is probably more grassroots conservative opposition to these disastrous trade agreements than there is liberal opposition.
Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see if the right wing, particularly the hate radio wing of it, can mount enough opposition to actually stop it.
Well, their problem is exactly what it, Barbo was his name, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. What Barbo was saying, the grassroots, not all, but most of the grassroots Republicans instinctively know that these trade policies have been a disaster for America. Why would you do a new one? That's what Barbo was saying.
Yeah.
But the big money interests who fund the Republican Party, well, they think differently. So we will see what happens.
Jason, in Arlington, Virginia, you're on the Arizona Senator Sanders.
Hey, how are you? I just know that in a few months we're going to have to talk about the Patriot Act again. I was wondering what your thoughts are in terms of that and who is in your corner.
Well, you know, in terms of the Patriot Act, I am one of the relatively few who have voted against it originally, the USA Patriot Act, and voted against its reauthorization. And the Patriot Act, though, is one part of a bigger issue. And it's a huge issue which, like so many other huge issues, just doesn't get the kind of discussion that we need. And that is this whole issue of privacy under modern technology. Obviously, the Patriot Act deals with the role of the government. We know that the government, every phone call that you make is now not listened to, but it's on file, so they know when you called, where you called from, to whom you called. We know that the government is active in terms of people's websites, where they visit, perhaps emails. That is the case, but it's not just the government. You have private sector things where people have enormous amounts of information about your health records, what kind of medicine you buy, what kind of, your bills to hospitals. The attack, you know, there are videos every time you walk down the street. There's a video taking a picture of you. You're driving your car. There are videos on roads. At any given moment, your iPhone can tell people exactly where you are. The attack on privacy, the right to live your own life without other people knowing every damn thing about you, has been incomprehensible in the last 20 or 30 years. And that's an issue that has to be addressed. So bottom line is, of course, we want our government to be vigorous in protecting us from privacy, protecting us from terrorism. That no one debates. But the kind of attacks that we see on privacy rights, to me, is extraordinary and has to be dealt with. But to answer the caller's question, I voted against the USA Patriot Act, unless there are very, very significant improvements, and it would vote against it again.
Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment is that many American families are being crushed by daycare and pre-K expenses, and some find it a barrier to full-time employment. Some families, it's the largest monthly expense. My question, Senator Sanders, is would you or do you support universal pre-K and daycare?
Marty, great question, and thanks for it's funny, I was in New Hampshire a month ago or so, and there's a group of people who are working just on this issue, and they've done a great job raising consciousness about it, but we don't hear enough about it. We have in America today the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth. That's about 18%. Half the kids in our public schools aren't getting eligible for free lunches, reduced lunches. And the world has so changed in the last 30 or 40 years in terms of the ability of mothers to stay home. Mothers, by and large, are not staying home anymore. They have to go out and work because as wages go down, family after family needs two breadwinners. That's the norm now. It used to not be the norm. That's the norm. So if dad goes to work, if mom goes to work, and you have a two-year-old, who's taking care of that baby? And the answer is Right now, child care is enormously expensive. In many parts of this country, it is virtually impossible to find good quality, affordable child care. So to answer Marty's question, absolutely, absolutely. And the evidence is clear. There have been study after study on this, that when you invest in good quality child care, kids do better in school. Kids do better in school, they don't drop out. If they don't drop out, they don't end up in jail where we spend $50,000, $80,000 a year, you know, keeping them behind bars. So investing in young children is a wonderful investment for this country. Create huge amounts of jobs. Meanwhile, today, you have people taking care of kids who are making minimum wage, which and are not don't have the training that they need. So answer Marty's question, absolutely, I believe in that.
Yeah, this is all 30 seconds of the break. This is also a symptom of the absolute Reaganomics need for families to have two workers.
Absolutely. You know, Tom, you and I mean, in so many ways, when we talk about the collapse of the American middle class, think 40, 50 years ago. You wanted to go to college 40, 50 years ago? You can go to a good state university. Tuition was free.
Right.
Say you can't afford it.
Yep.
40 or 50 years ago, one breadwinner to take care of the family. Today, you need two working long hours.
Yep, and maybe working three jobs.
Maybe.
Senator Sanders with us. Senator Bernie Sanders. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Bernie Sanders right after this, 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And over at Bernie's website, you can sign up for his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz. And it's also a great news site, just a general news site, Sanders.Senate.gov. Check it out. Welcome back. And let's see here. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, watching on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thanks, gentlemen. I know the UAW doesn't want cheap, reliable, high-quality cars being imported to compete with the junk that our so-called American companies sometimes build. But if the TPP raises standards and wages in other countries, won't that help American workers?
The answer is, yeah, maybe. But every one of these agreements, oh, we have environmental standards, oh, we have labor standards. The question of who's going to really enforce these standards. And yes, I would hope that all of us want to see that low-income people around the world do better. But what has been going on, Paul, in my view, in this country for the last 30 or 40 years, is that we have been engaged in a race to the bottom by which we are becoming competitive with the rest of the world because wages and benefits are going down in America. So if you weigh all the pluses and the minuses of the TPP, there is no question in my mind that this is a big minus, that it is another attack on working families. And it's not just the UAW. It is virtually every union in this country. And as we learned a little while ago from a conservative from Texas who called in, there's a lot of conservative Republicans. They just look, here's the fact. If you are a corporation, you are General Electric, the General Motors, and you can build a product abroad with wages that are half or a third of what they are in the United States, what are you going to do? Well, you go abroad, and that's exactly what they have done. Not very complicated. So I think this agreement is bad. I should say is that I do believe in trade. I think every sensible person believes in trade, and you can develop trade agreements that work for working people. Trade's a good thing. But the goal of the trade agreements has got to be for prosperity for American workers, prosperity for foreign workers in other countries, not for simply more and more profits for the large multinationals.
Kent in Henderson, Arkansas, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. Yesterday we had at our small two-year college Supreme Court Judge Antonin Scalia and retired Judge Charles Pickering showed up to give a speech titled The Presidency and the Constitution. Wondered if you knew that he was making the rounds to little small two-year colleges. Population 12,000.
To be honest with you, I don't follow very, very closely the doings and the travel plans of Mr. Scalia is not somebody who I have hold in very profound respect.
It does, though, in the 30 seconds of the break, it does raise the specter of the next president appointing possibly three, maybe four. I mean, when the 2016, you're going to have three members of the Supreme Court over 80.
Right. And this, let me just, and that's absolutely right. And that is certainly one of the important functions of a president. And to simply say that I cannot recall a Supreme Court that has been more political and more dangerous to the well-being of this country than the current United States Supreme Court. The damage they have done is incalculable.
Yeah. Maybe Roger Taney could compete with it. I don't know. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be back with more of your questions for Bernie right after this. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls. And let's see here. Andrew, in Normal, Illinois, you're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Such a pleasure to speak to you, and thank you for the show, Tom.
Sure.
In order for a guy like you to get elected president or even a populist movement to start in this country, I think it needs to cross party lines. And I don't think that, as evidenced by callers, that Republican or right voters want this country to become an oligarchy, and I think that they see the threat. So my question is, how do we form that kind of movement that spans party lines in such a toxic political environment? That's my first question.
Well, Andrew, good question. The first thing that we have to do is to know that in terms of analysis or emphasis, much of what you see in the corporate media is wrong. It's just wrong. I mean, these are guys who sit around and, you know, they work for people who are very, very wealthy, and they talk to each other, and they really, in many cases, I don't want to overdo it. There's some brilliant writers out there who write excellent articles. Every now and then, there's really some good TV out there. But by and large, these guys are wrong. And I think your point is that if you look at the issues, you know, we got a call this afternoon from some conservative fellow from Texas. What the Republicans have done brilliantly is figured out a way to divide people up primarily on cultural issues. For example, in Kansas right now, there's this very, very ugly thing that Governor Brownback there is doing, which is telling poor people who are receiving government assistance they can't go to the movies, they can't go into swimming pools. It is, and why do you do these things? Well, the real reason is to tell working people who don't have any health care, working people are working 50 or 60 hours a week, that the enemy, their enemy, is the poor people. Meanwhile, in the Senate and in the House, the Republicans have given $260+ billion in tax breaks to the wealthiest 0.2% by repealing the estate tax. So what this is about, say, you're working hard and all these poor people are taking your money. Well, many of these poor people are unemployed. Many of these poor people are moms trying to raise their kids. But the goal then is to beat up and focus attention on the poor people rather than the billionaires who receive all kinds of corporate welfare, who in some cases, as corporations, with their own corporations, are not paying a nickel in taxes. And that's what the Republicans do very well. So to answer Andrew's question, the way you overcome, you know, the party fractionalism that we see in the country is to say to working people, yeah, we may disagree on this or that issue, but do you think it is appropriate that our jobs get shipped to China? Do you think it's appropriate that billionaires get huge amounts of tax breaks and that you may be paying an effective tax rate higher than a billionaire, that corporations in some cases pay nothing in taxes? Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think it's a good idea that we're the only country in the industrialized world that doesn't guarantee health care to all people? Do you think it's a good idea that 99% of all new income is going to the top 1%? You know what a lot of those folks will say? They say, no, we don't think that's a good idea. So what we have to do to bring people together around the progressive agenda is recognize there'll be cultural differences on issues like abortion, gay marriage, guns, etc., and that's the way it is. But our goal is to overcome those by saying, fine, we can disagree, but let's focus on a progressive economic agenda which protects working families and our children.
It's the economy, stupid sort of thing.
That's right. That is pretty much it.
Okay.
In a democracy, people are going to disagree, right?
Yep. Wayne in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good morning. Very quick comment, very quick question. Americans have a fatal flaw of choosing imagery and style over substance. Therefore, that's why they have present occupant of White House being a complete sellout to the bankers and the international and national corporations. My question, Mr. Sanders, is the mainstream media right now is saying that Fast Track is a done deal. Can you explain to us exactly what happened yesterday?
Yep.
And how many Democrats are actually involved in this sellout?
Wayne, what happened yesterday was in the United States Senate, the committee that handles this is called the Finance Committee. That's, they have jurisdiction over trade. The chairman of it is Orrin Hatch of Utah. Ranking member is Ron Wyden of the state of Oregon. Wyden and Hatch introduced the fast-track legislation. They were quibbling over it for a long time and going over the details of it. They just reached the conclusion. There was a hearing rushed through on Thursday, I guess yesterday, very quickly, which I know that some people were very upset about how quick it moved, where they heard testimony from, I believe, Mr. Froman, the trade representative. And then it's going to go, it will be voted on in the committee, and then it goes to the floor of the Senate. And it will require 60 votes to get past the Senate. It will require a majority to get past the House. If I were a betting guy, I would say it will likely get the 60 votes in the Senate. Not definite. There are a number of uncommitted. But I would think, yes, in the House, it's going to be closer. So that's kind of where we are, Wayne.
Interesting. Senator, we have 1 minute left in the hour.
Well, let me just kind of wrap it up. Great questions today. You know, maybe get back to the question Andrew from Illinois raised a moment ago, and how do we bring people together? And I think we bring people together by recognizing that in a democracy, folks on this or that issue will have heartfelt differences of opinion, and that's the way it is. But that on basic economic issues, whether or not our country should evolve into an oligarchic form of society where a handful of billionaire families have so much money that they can control not only Wall Street and the economy, but also our political system. You know what? If you're a conservative, you don't think that's a good idea. And if you're progressive, you surely don't think that's a good idea. If you're in the middle of the road, you don't think it's a good idea. So how we break through a media which isn't particularly interested in talking about that, that is our challenge, but I think we can do it. So, and this program is an important part of that educational effort.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday, so pretty much whatever's on your mind, we can pick up and kick around. I did want to highlight a couple of things. The House of Representatives yesterday passed a piece of legislation. Gee, what a surprise. They actually can pass laws and that don't repeal Obamacare, although they did. They tried to do that again, not yesterday, but in this last week. But this was a bill that would specifically benefit people like the Koch brothers. The House on Wednesday, this from Politico, Ken Vogel and Hillary Flynn writing, the House on Wednesday with little fanfare and virtually no media coverage. I added that part. Passed legislation that would protect major donors like the Koch brothers, and then they got to throw in Tom Steyer, right? And Tom Steyer from having to pay gift taxes on huge donations to secret money political groups. I could be wrong about Tom Steyer, but I think he's been pretty transparent, and he's not using secret money groups. He's using, nonprofits, but the ones that disclose. But I could be wrong. I think not, but I could be wrong on that. And I think that they just threw Tom Steyer in there to throw a sop to the conservatives, who will get hysterical when they say, oh, the Republicans in the House of Representatives just passed something that will help the Republican donors. But really, it's the major recipients of this. Well, actually, it says Tom Steyer's Next Gen Climate is a 501c4. Yeah. The bill passed Wednesday would make clear that the gift tax does not apply to groups registered under Section 501c4, 5, or 6. And that covers a wide swath of organizations. This is from the Politico article, including everything from the Karl Rove conceived Crossroads GPS and Tom Steyer funded Next Gen Climate, both of which are 501c4s, to major labor unions, 501c5s, to the Koch brothers backed Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce, 501c6. I didn't even know there was a six. Amazing. Well, it'll be real interesting to see. I mean, this is an effort to make big money in politics even more opaque, not more transparent. So whether, it's gotten out of the House. Of course, the House is run by right-wing Republican shills for the billionaires and the big corporations. Whether it'll make it through the Senate, where the Democrats still assert some authority, and whether the president would sign it, which I'd be very skeptical about. Frankly, I can't see any Democrat signing this. But, time will tell. Anyhow, George in Chicago. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hello, Tom.
Hey.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a question I wanted to address to Senator Sanders, and hopefully somebody in his office is listening to the show. Two examples of the deterioration of broadcasting I've heard in the last 24 hours. Yesterday evening on the ABC National News, they reported on the gentleman who landed his gyrocopter on the Capitol lawn. And they did not mention once what his purpose was, to deliver 535 letters to all the senators and congressmen about his dismay at the state of campaign financing.
Right.
The thread that ran through was one of danger and threat and terrorism. If this guy can do it, terrorists could do it.
Right.
But nothing about the enormous damage that has been done and continues to be done by our campaign financing. Second example, earlier today on NPR, they did a very brief and very shallow report on the TPP and interviewed some obscure academic from England on the subject, and England's not even a party to these negotiations, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a kind of a frothy, chit-chatty report. And I just thought, NPR is like totally captive to its corporate donors. You can't get good news out of networks or NPR anymore. And then Senator Sanders mentioned that he's grateful for your show because it gives him platform to speak on these issues. I would just like to suggest to the senator and advocate to the Democrats that in the next session, they have to introduce a bill that restores the public service requirements to broadcasting, because as long as the sources of news for most of our people are so corporate oriented, we're not going to make much progress.
Right. And we've been moving more and more in that direction with public radio. Public radio has gone from being 100% funded by the federal government in the 1960s when Lyndon Johnson created it to 7% last year. And, you know, what's making up the difference is you know, the gas industry, the oil industry, the defense industry, all, you know, the lobbyists here in D.C., you hear all the ads for the lobbying firms and, you know, all these other companies that want to make sure that NPR does not do any investigative journalism that looks bad on them. It's really not a good thing. So I can't speak for Bernie, but I think that we need to go back to ownership rules, that the FCC used to have ownership rules that limited the amount of media that one family or one corporation could own in any individual city or across the United States. And I think that that's a reasonable thing. I think it's good for local communities. I think it's good for business. It does introduce a certain amount of inefficiency into the system. And frankly, I've been thinking for years I ought to write a book called In Praise of Inefficiency. Frankly, I think that's a good thing. And I've seen the radio business when it was fragmented and local back in the 60s and 70s. I was in the radio business. And I see it now where, you know, it's like basically three companies in radio own the country. If five companies in television own the country. And is that a good thing for democracy? I don't think so. George, thank you for the call. Rick in Minneapolis, let's see, on AM 950. Hey, Rick, what's an independently owned station, by the way. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, I was very excited to hear Bernie talking about what we could do to get people organized and excited about changing our country. I was very inspired by my experience of that moment of silence in New York City with the People's Climate March with 400,000 people. And my idea is for us to do that every day or any day. Stand up for a moment of silence. They just did this in Israel where they, stopped to honor the people who were killed in the Holocaust. And what if we had a clear focus on five main issues? Citizens United, campaign financing, get the Fairness Doctrine back, the Glass-Steagall Act, and fix the Voting Rights Act. And if we could do those things every day or whenever people could do it, you know, here's people standing up, being silent for a minute with a hand up in the air. And then when you bring your hand down, people could cheer or hug each other or pass out flyers saying, this is what we're focused on, these five main issues.
Right.
And then if we can get those done, then we can address other things like Black Lives Matter, busting up the big banks, immigration reform and stuff. But what about doing that around the country and excite people and empower them to actually have a focus on major issues that would make some changes?
Great idea, Rick. Make it happen.
Well, I've been working on it.
I'm trying
to get people at my church to do it, and I want to get a letter to Bernie, and I was trying to hand this letter to you at the Blue State Ball.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, this is my idea, and I think it could make a difference.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways to do these things, and the things ultimately, if you look at the history of movements that are successful, they're typically successful, not necessarily because they have a brilliant idea, although, you know, usually that's sort of a precondition, but because they have people with passion and commitment behind them and people who don't give up, people who just keep pushing and pushing and pushing and saying, you know, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to make it happen. This is what we're absolutely committed to. You know, there's a certain level of benevolent fanaticism necessary for that. So I wish you well, Rick. Thanks a lot for the call. And good on you for your activism. It is 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I would add, don't expect a moment of silence or a minute of silence on the radio, because when radio networks shows go silent for a minute, alarms go off all over the country. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jarrett in Kenmore, Washington, watching us on YouTube. Hey, hey Jarrett, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I do. I hear you just fine.
Okay, thank you. So Thank you for hosting Senator Sanders. First of all, you know, I want to obviously address this question to him, but I'd also like to pick your brain on this because I think it's a thought-provoking question, but maybe it's not. So as a student and then, you know, as a progressive, someone who is a very big proponent of higher education and, you know, a progressive agenda of getting affordable or free tuition in the United States, as a lot of Western Europe and other parts of the world have, the one sort of, I guess, issue that I'm a little on the fence about is how do you sort of account for different degree programs providing, you know, the type of training that will ultimately contribute to at different levels to the economy. So, you know, say you have someone who graduates with a degree in engineering, they go on to, you know, work at an engineering firm, and then compare that to someone who, you know, gets a degree that I do respect, because I do respect the liberal arts, but something that's like political science, and then they don't sort of have that sort of futuristic, you know, workforce sort of training, and they have a harder time finding a job. So I guess my question is, how do you sort of account for, you know, different degree programs and their contributions to the economy after they graduate from college? And then how can you incentivize students to, you know, pursue those more futuristic, you know, sort of STEM jobs, as they're generally called, or right, jobs like medicine or teachers, stuff like that?
Yeah. Excuse me. Can't hit my sneeze button on my foot here. I'm sorry. I've got a cold. Forgive me if I sneeze. My experience as an employer has been that the degree is almost irrelevant. I have had people apply for and work for me in, for example, in the radio business, who have degrees about, you know, how to do radio stuff, and their learning curve is a little shorter than somebody who doesn't. But if they're not motivated, if they're not enthusiastic, if they're not committed, if they're not the kind of person who's always looking for how can I do a little better, how can I make this, you know, how can I be a part of the team, how can I make this thing better than it was yesterday, if there's not that sense of continual improvement, then I frankly don't care what their skill set is. In fact, hiring people with no college or any training at all, apropos of their skill set, has actually done very well for me over the years in a whole variety of different applications. I mean, first successful business I ever owned, the guy that I hired as a secretary ended up being vice president of the company. I mean, I think that a 4-year education or college education, one, demonstrates that you have the persistence and focus to put up with 4 years of college. Two, I mean, one of the best people I've ever worked with, Sam Sachs, who helped write the DiCaprio documentary that just came out, that's over at greenworldrising.org right now with me, has a degree in philosophy. So I've got no problem with soft degrees, as it were. And if somebody wants to work in one of the STEM fields, good luck and God bless them. But I don't see it in those terms, Jared. I think that there's a lot of value to these softer degrees. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Yeah, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind?
Hi, good afternoon, Tom.
Hey.
Hope you feel better, because I could tell earlier in the week that you sounded like you had a cold.
Yeah, yesterday was the worst day. In fact, last night I was like, I got to get to bed. I'm dying. But today it's just, you know, a little leftover, plugged up, occasional sneeze. So I'm healing. I'm on the mend. So what's up, Charles?
Oh,
thanks for your kind words.
Well, I want to ask Senator Sanders this question, but it's no problem. During the last election, which is just a couple of months ago, we heard from the Republicans that, you know, Obama was cooking the books as far as the economy and the unemployment rate.
Right.
And they were saying that so many people were still, you know, unemployed. Well, since day one, since January 1st, or whenever they took over, the 20th, I'm not sure. They have not introduced any jobs bill. They haven't passed any jobs bill. You know, they've changed the narratives to Obama and Iran and Obama and ISIS, Obama and, you know, the whole world blowing up except jobs. And we have to hold their feet to the fire because no matter what, you know, we still have an economy to run. In fact, it seems like the economy is probably declining a little because there's been a couple of times this week that I heard that the Dow was down. Walgreens is losing. They're going to close a couple hundred stores. And, you know, we're worrying about the leader of Iran.
Right.
That is, and it has its place. But, you know, we have to get this economy started. And the last thing I want to say is basically the way that we treat women as far as not standing up for them, that they should have equal pay. You know, their rights are important, too. If we want to have an economy that's actually going to be more robust, they do, you know, that we should offer them equal pay because they pay into the economy probably even more than we do. And second of all, as far as revenue, they contribute to government revenue as well. They pay taxes or they get taxes taken out of their paychecks. And that also goes to Social Security.
Right.
You know, they also contribute to what's putting in, you know, what we put in the pot. So we have to be fair to them as well. You know, that's my statement for the day, and I love you, Tom, and I hope you feel better.
Thank you, Charles. I appreciate it. Apropos to your question of whether it seems like the Republicans are actually trying to make the economy contract, one of the most consequential variables that will determine who becomes elected president of the United States is the quality of the economy in the 6 months leading up to the election. And in fact, there's Republicans running around saying that if George Bush hadn't crashed the economy 6 months before 2008, that John McCain would be president right now. And it may be true. But this is arguably the most consequential thing. So knowing this, Republicans know this. I mean, this is an open secret. It's no, you know, doesn't take a rocket scientist. They're going to do everything they can to crash the economy between now and November of 2016, which is why I titled my book, The Crash of 2016. In the hopes that the Republican crashing of the economy will be blamed on Obama and thus will be blamed on Democrats. Now, here's the big variable. Will it work? Because the Republicans control both the House and the Senate. So if the economy crashes, you know, are the American people, the Republicans are going to be spinning this like crazy. Oh, it's all Obama's fault. Oh, it's all Obama's fault. Are the American people going to buy that? Now, they're going to have the Republicans will have billions of dollars to sell that. We'll see where it goes. Thomas in Sacramento, California. Hey, Thomas, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, Thomas. An honor.
Thank you.
I wanted to pose the question to Sanders about if he knew where Hillary stood on TPP in the Keystone XL pipeline.
I don't think anybody knows where she stands on those two things, Thomas. The Keystone XL pipeline, of course, she was Secretary of State. State Department makes the decision. That decision has not come down yet and then gets kind of ratified by the president. So for her to take that on before he does something with it would be probably politically inappropriate. With regard to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, well, probably same thing. You know, for her to knock either one while the leader of her party and the President of the United States is trying to, you know, I don't know about Keystone XL, but he's certainly trying to push Trans-Pacific Partnership, or SHAFTA, as I call it. So I would be surprised if she came out and opposed her own president. Whether she supports it or opposes it, I don't know. But I would be surprised. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I honestly don't know, Thomas. Sorry. Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hey, Margie, what's up?
I wanted to discuss the dangers of nuclear power plants.
Okay.
I am not, I'm sure most people are aware that a week ago Thursday, a F4 tornado hit north of Rochelle, Illinois. What nobody has discussed is that F4 200 mile per hour tornado hit at maximum 8 miles from the Byron nuclear power plant.
Oh my. So we could have had a Fukushima near Chicago.
we could have had a Fukushima near Chicago. I just ran the numbers. I know one of the buildings that the tornado actually destroyed, using that as my point, it was no more than 8 miles and could very well bend less.
Wow.
We could have just, and that has two reactors, and it was built in 85. So that is a 30-year-old power plant.
Wow.
Nobody has even mentioned it.
Right. Huh. Time, Shane? 5 seconds. Okay. Yeah. Margie, it's so amazing. We're building two power plants right now. I think one in Georgia and one in South Carolina. Maybe they're both in Georgia, but down in the Southeast. And we would not even have nuclear power in the United States if it wasn't for the Price Anderson Act that puts you and me on the hook for the liability of these guys. Thanks for sharing that story, Margie. That's horrifying. And it's good to know. You know, it's important stuff to know. It's 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
28 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. Your call's up next. Tom Hartman here with you. You've heard me many times point out how Republicans view government as something to extract money from. Pure and simple. And here's another example. Privatization is the grossest example. And this is something that got really, really, shiny and glittery. And, oh, boy, isn't this cool during the Reagan administration. And it has, for 35 years, there's just been this steady move toward privatization of government functions. The idea being that private corporations, because of competition, will be more efficient than government organizations. But then government goes out and instead of hiring a whole bunch of small companies, they contract with one giant contractor. There's basically no competition. There's no efficiency. Things cost more. I mean, we saw this in Iraq. We see it all over the military. It's everywhere. So from a Republican point of view, if there are any government programs at all that are running well, they should be privatized, not to increase their efficiency or decrease their costs. Because the thing that we've learned, and again, it's writ large, our defense contract and our intelligence contracts or our intelligence industries. The thing that we've learned is that when you privatize things, it actually gets more expensive and less efficient. Because the for-profit corporations, they've got to be able to take enough money off the top for the dividends for their stockholders and for the CEO's salary and for the advertising and marketing and all the stuff that goes with being a for-profit company. For-profit health insurance companies in this country, for example, typically run on a 20 to 35% overhead. You know, that's the money that they're using to pay for the private jet with the gold-plated, water faucet that takes the executives to their vacation homes. I mean, that's and whereas Medicare and Medicaid run on an overhead of around 2%. Because the people working there are government bureaucrats who are making a government salary, a government pension, and they're just, they're there to do the job. So anyhow, the Republicans now have come out and said, hey, let's privatize the FAA. See, in September, the funding for the FAA runs out, the Federal Aviation Administration, the control towers, the controllers. So Florida's Republican Congressman John Mica has said, let's privatize it. Right. The other thing I wanted to mention, and then I'll pick up your calls, I'd like to get your take on this. Britt McHenry, this woman who works for ESPN, this video has gone viral, although in place after place, we were looking for it this morning, place after place, it appears to have been taken down. I'm not sure who's doing damage control or how, or if there's some sort of, I don't know how you can assert copyright on something like that on a security video. But you can't assert lawsuit threats, I suppose. But, she's berating this employee of a towing service. Apparently her car was towed. And she starts yelling at this person. I believe it's a woman. We can't see the person she's yelling at. We don't know their race or their age or their gender. I believe it's a woman, though. And she says, This is what Britt says to the woman. She says, I'm in the news, sweetheart. I will effing sue this place. And then, you know, the woman says something, and she says, that's why I have a degree and you don't. I wouldn't work in a scumbag place like this. Makes my skin crawl even being here. And then she says to the woman, yep, that's all you care about is just taking people's money with no education, no skill set. Just wanted to clarify that. You feel good about your job? So I can be a college dropout and do the same thing? Why? Because I have a brain and you don't? Maybe if I was missing some teeth, they'd hire me, huh? Because they, your teeth, they look so stunning. Because I'm on television and you're in an effing trailer, honey. Lose some weight, baby girl. So this is the this ESPN host who has been for a week put on temporary leave or whatever they call that. But it raises two interesting questions. The first is the nature of our media. I mean, here's a woman who's thin, attractive, and blonde. We've talked on this program a lot about white privilege and about male privilege. It's been a while since I've talked about the privilege associated with appearance, and there's that too. And is that, you know, a skinny privilege, let's call it, or handsome privilege or whatever? And it's true. The politicians are more likely to get elected. People are more likely to get a job if they're relatively attractive by the definitions of our contemporary culture, as opposed to if not. And, you know, which is not good news for the 90% of the population that's just kind of, you know, normal folk. So, A, what does it say about our media that they're going to bring her back because, hey, you know, finding attractive women who can do sports? I don't know, but what does it say about our media? But I think more importantly, this looks to me, and I don't know Britt McHenry, and in fact, I'd like to take the conversation away from her and move it to a more general frame of, I have observed in my years on this earth that there are some people who are what I call kiss up, kick down folks. They kiss up to people who have power or fame or can give them something. They kiss up to their bosses and they kick down to the people below them. As they're climbing the ladder of success, they're kissing on the way up, kissing, I suppose, metaphorically, the feet or the rear ends of the people ahead of them. And the people below them who are also trying to climb the ladder, they're constantly kicking them down. And, you know, in business we refer to it as the kiss-up, kick-down personality. And I have a real problem with these kind of folks. I try never to hire them. I try not to work with them. But in show business, there are a lot of such people, particularly in on-air talent. And I think it comes out of some fundamental insecurity. But, you know, have you ever known somebody who's one of these kiss-up, kick-down folks? And how have you handled it? I mean, this woman that Britt McHenry was berating handled it really well. She said, you know, you're on security camera. And then everything else she said was just very polite, which makes the video even more shocking, I think. So, anyhow, Nancy, speaking of male privilege, you wanted to talk, Nancy, in Oak Lawn, Illinois, about Hillary Clinton and misogyny. Go for it.
Yes. Now, hear me out.
Okay.
You know, you're going to think I'm crazy. This country just isn't going to, it's too misogynistic. It's just not going to vote in a woman right from the get-go, and especially Hillary because, well, in my opinion, too, I'm sick of Bush's and Hillary and Clinton's. I think we should. But my thought is if we could get the rich progressives behind Senator Sanders, the way, you know, the rich oligarchs are over there on the Republican side, and we can get his name out there and his voice out there, and he chooses Elizabeth Warren as his vice president, or even Hillary, then I think we've got something. Because I think the only way, this country is just too misogynistic, too racist. The only way a woman is going to get to be president is by being vice president first.
You know, in 2008, I had on this program the vice president of the California Democratic Party. Actually, it wasn't the statewide party. It was one of the county parties. But he was an African-American. And he was taking the position, at which I actually believed to be the case for a few months. He was taking the position that America is too racist to elect a black man president. And he was wrong, and I thought America was too racist to do it for a while there. And then I got, you know, then I looked around and said, hey, whoa, we're doing this, and got really excited about it. And I would love to see a woman president. I would.
You know. I would, too.
Yeah. But misogyny does run deeper than racism in this country. It's, you know.
Right. And I understand what you're saying. But look what they did to that black president once he did get in.
Yeah. But on the other hand, African Americans make up, what, 16-17% of the American population, 14% something. It's in the teens. Women make up more than half the population. So, you know,
right,
misogyny may be pretty awful. You know, just like racism is pretty awful, but you've got, frankly, I think more racists in this country than misogynists, just because of those numbers.
Take it from me. I'm a woman, and my woman friends, a lot of them, right off the bat, they say, no Hillary. And when I try to explain to them that the worst Democrat would be better, 1,000% better than the best Republican, and don't forget, now, I don't trust any of our elections. Now, they have ways to control the elections, no matter, I know if we get 1,000% out there, then, you know, they'd win, but, you know, we're not getting it. And they're not getting, Democrats are not getting their message across.
Yeah.
And the reason Rove's head exploded when the election was over last time is because he thought they were stealing the election again.
Right, he thought he had it rigged.
Right.
I think that, you know, there were a bunch of machines that Anonymous had identified as being part of the Karl Rove rigging operation, and they said they were going to out it, and they said that if he tried to stop them, they would out him, and I think they did. I think they took down the Republican vote stealing operation, or at least some, you know, enough pieces of it. But I could be wrong. I mean, who knows? I'm guessing over in Republican land, they're convinced that Anonymous hacked the voting machines to give the presidency to President Obama. I've certainly seen a lot of those. If you Google, you know, hacked voting machines or voting machine fraud, you find a lot of right-wing threads, a lot of paranoia out there. Nancy, thank you for the call. We'll see. I mean, you know, do you think that our country is too misogynistic to elect a woman as president? I think the time has come. Now, whether it's Hillary Clinton or not, I mean, that's a whole other thing, but I think the time has come. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, I remember when Geraldine Ferraro was running for vice president, and I thought the time had come back then. We need to get this done. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV.
And again, thank you, Tom, for what you do.
Sure.
And thank you enough.
Thank you.
Listen, listening to Bernie Sanders earlier, I think he's explaining to Shanna from Seattle, I'm thinking, with all the money that he mentions and all the money we hear, all these millions and now billions of dollars just for electoral politics being spent, you know that money represents energy. And it's not the energy being expended by these people who hold the money, you know, the CEOs and all these ultra-rich guys. There's money that they take from their employees. So I'm thinking it's time that we use the talents of forensic accountants, not just limit their practice to the courtroom, but have them do the explaining better than Bill Clinton could ever hope to do, being that Bill Clinton takes money from the same rich guys who are trying to buy off the elections.
Right.
I don't know how to do that, who to go to. If there's an association that you're aware of that maybe you can invite some of these folks on and get that dialogue going. I think that would be a valuable thing.
A dialogue about
American people, because people love money when it comes to their money. They want to know. That's what activates them. When they're hungry, that's when they get active. And you threaten their pocketbook, and you show their pocketbook is being emptied out by these Wall Street hoodlums.
Well, it's amazing when you look at the numbers. I mean, there's been a transfer of over $10 trillion. Some numbers, some estimates put it as high as $16 or $18 trillion. From the middle class to the top 1% over the last 30 years. This is the essence of Reaganomics, making the middle class poor, making the rich super rich. So you've got that going on. You've got, you know, all this money pouring into politics now as a result of the Supreme Court saying that money is protected by the First Amendment, which is an absolutely bizarre argument, you know, that therefore we can't limit free speech. But we limit free speech all the time in order to expand it. You know, you go to a city council meeting, there's 50 people who want to speak. They each get 2 minutes, right, because you got 2 hours to talk. And by doing that, you get all 50 people in. We have a long history of limiting free speech in order to make it better, in order to make it work. But
we have seniors on Medicare and free time Social Security who have to choose between paying their light bill and eating dog and cat food. There's right. No excuse for that. We should be able to triple their benefits a month and have free college for folks and forgive current college debt. And go after these Wall Street guys and spend the money to prosecute them and then seize their assets, because that's where that money is going. It's going in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Yeah. It's truly astonishing when you look at the kind of money. I mean, the Koch brothers added billions to their net wealth just in the last couple of years. And so to just peel off a billion here or a billion there, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, they're worth somewhere between $80 and $100 billion. They were worth in the 50s or 60s of billions of dollars back a few years ago when they really started coming out of the political scene. It's a mind-boggling amount of money. And to say, okay, you know, if we want to make another $10 billion, so we'll take $1 billion and we'll invest it in politics. We'll buy a bunch of politicians, and out of that will come, you know, the political power and the tax breaks and the industry specific favors and, you know, the subsidies or whatever that we need. It's just wrong. And I believe that the average, and thank you, Johnny, for the call. I think that the average American has figured out that the game is rigged. It's one of the reasons why Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders draw so well. The average American has figured that out. The question is, who will carry that mantle? Who can do that? Because it's going to reach one of those 1936 moments like with Franklin Roosevelt, where the candidate is going to have to say, they hate me and I welcome their hatred. We'll be right back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us, brought to you by the story of Sholene and Kier, the slave from South Sudan. You can view it at thankless.com/watch. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on today?
Very interesting court ruling today from the D.C. Circuit.
Okay.
The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of the National Labor Relations Board. The court said that it could not force unions to take down Facebook posts threatening workers for crossing a picket line. Now, it said that unlike in some public settings, a union is not responsible for the behavior of its members on a private online Facebook page. Now, this centered on Facebook comments that were posted during a six-day 2012 strike launched by a Phoenix branch of the Amalgamated Transit Union against a bus company. And in the comments, some union members criticized workers who crossed the picket line, said some pretty rude things. Now, the union did not endorse the posts, and you could only get to the Facebook page if you were a member of the union. But one employee at the bus company, who was not a union member, said the union broke the law by declining to take the Facebook comments down. Brought his case to the NLRB. They decided not to take action. Ended up at the Circuit Court of Appeals, and they said the private nature of the Facebook page made it different than a public picket line.
So that's really interesting. So the D.C. Circuit, one step below the U.S. Supreme Court, has now said that Facebook is not public, basically. It's not a public space.
Well, not a public space, because this was a private Facebook page.
Oh, you mean it was one that was not accessible to the general public?
Right. It's a private Facebook page.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, in that case, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So they were not responsible.
Right. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. Okay. I thought that we were redefining what what is public and what is private space and where do the commons begin and end and all that. But no, this is much narrower. Okay, makes perfect sense.
Right, they were saying it was meant for union members' eyes only, and that the speech complained of here occurred on a private forum. Yeah. And so they said that that the NLRB was not responsible.
Okay. So what else?
Interesting quote. Interesting rule. President Obama today at a joint press conference with the Prime Minister of Italy vented his frustration over the delay in confirming his Attorney General pick Loretta Lynch. He called the Senate's handling of her nomination embarrassing. It's gone too far, he said, of the Senate gamesmanship, as he called it. Enough, enough. Call Loretta Lynch for a vote. He called it a crazy situation because senators have not disputed her qualifications. What are we doing here? There is no reason for it. Nobody can describe a reason for it beyond political gamesmanship in the Senate.
Well, I can describe a reason. The Republicans are you know, it's election season, and Loretta Lynch is both black and female, and, you know, Republicans are Republicans. I'll leave it at that, but back to you, Victoria.
Also at the press conference, President Obama pressed liberals in Congress to back his trade agenda. He warned that a defeat of the trade agreements he's negotiating would be a, quote, ratification of the status quo. Now, he did say that the politics of trade have always been tough for Democrats, but he said that the new trade pacts with Asians and European nations would absolutely be good for workers and businesses. Now, he said that the accusations from labor unions that the trade agreements were a giveaway to corporate America are not true. If I didn't think this deal was a good one, I wouldn't do it, he said.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not buying it, but okay. Right.
House Speaker John Boehner said today he hopes the Obama administration fails to reach a deal on Iran's nuclear program. This was very interesting because you remember that Speaker Boehner invited Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel to come to Congress to speak to make his case against it, against the Iran deal before the P5 plus one had finished negotiating. So Boehner said today on Fox Business Channel, I've never been optimistic that we get to an agreement, a real agreement that would stop the nuclear threat from Iran. And I don't think the Iranians have any intention of giving up their desire for a nuclear weapon. Asked whether he's expecting an agreement, I would hope not.
Yeah. That's unfortunate.
The Obama administration is up before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans today to argue an immigration case, its executive actions from November. Basically, it wants to convince a three-judge panel to lift a lower court ruling that's blocked the government from implementing the executive actions to shield undocumented immigrants from deportation and to grant them work permits.
Aren't all three of these judges conservative Republicans?
Two are. One is an Obama appointee.
Uh-huh. Okay. So this will be interesting.
It's going to be interesting. Very unusually, both sides have been given an hour, at least an hour, to make their case that a federal judge in Texas aired in February when he halted Obama's deferred action program. It's going to be very interesting. They won't actually have an hour to make their case. They're going to be repeatedly interrupted by the judges.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we'll see where that goes.
Yep.
The Tulsa, Oklahoma reserve deputy charged in the fatal shooting of a suspect went on national TV today to counter criticisms of his qualifications. Now, it came out yesterday, the Tulsa World published, that sheriff's office supervisors were ordered to falsify his training records. And in fact, some of them were removed when they refused to do so. He said it's not true. He said characterizations of himself as a wealthy donor who paid to join the force are unbelievably unfair. He said he is certified to be a reserve deputy. The 73-year-old said, I have it in writing.
Right. I think that's the problem, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway.
He's also the, he was also the re-election campaign manager for the sheriff.
Oh, isn't that special? Okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by the story of Sholin and Kira, the slave from South Sudan, at thankless.com/watch. Victoria, have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and 6.5 minutes past the hour. Susan in Worcester, Ohio. Hey, Susan, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up? What's up?
Hey, Tom. It's nice talking to you.
Thank you.
I'm calling about the white privilege thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have two children, and my daughter has a son. He's blue-eyed, blonde-haired, and he's in his mid-20s, and he married a multiracial woman who is half white, one quarter black, and one quarter Native American. They have three daughters. The youngest one looks like my grandson. She's got blue eyes and blonde hair. The middle one has brown hair, brown eyes, and looks white. The oldest daughter, however, has dark skin and African-American hair. Mm-hmm. And she is absolutely beautiful. However, when I take the girls anywhere, it doesn't matter where, people make the nastiest comments.
Really?
About why I have a little N-word girl with me. They talk amongst themselves, you know. And when we go out to eat as a big family, the oldest daughter, my oldest great-granddaughter is ignored, and everybody fawns over the two younger ones.
Hmm.
And, you know, my county is Republican, almost all white, and most of the people in our county are Amish or Mennonite, and they don't vote.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I'm combining two things here, two ideas, but the far right, like, for instance, we have letters to the editor constantly about how we're a Christian nation and how black people came from Cain, and, you know.
Really?
It's amazing to me. Oh, yeah. It's amazing to me how redneck I shouldn't say that, but, you know, how.
Well, racist would be a good word, Susan.
How racist these people are. And, you know, then white people wonder why these black children grow up with such a problem, you know, in their heads because of all the baloney that they've been through as youngsters. It makes me want to cry. It makes me sick. I try to protect her from it, and you can't. It's out there. It's just there. And I mean, I can't even take her to Walmart for that. Well, that's probably not a good example either, but I can't take her anywhere, you know, in this area without having some kind of bigotry occur.
Hmm.
And, you know, she gets it in school.
Hmm.
She gets it in school. She's, you know, her teachers, you know, they act like she's not bright. And I know this because my grandson, you know, goes to the teacher meetings, the parent-teacher conferences, et cetera. And the thing of it is that she's an A student, you know, and she reads when she's eight. And, you know, she's an awesome, awesome child.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder to myself, how is she going to grow up you know, no wonder. It's no wonder that black children grow up with such problems and run from the police and, you know, do those things because they're afraid.
Yeah, I would say they grow up with so many wounds.
Yeah.
Wounded.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, when she was really little, we could protect her from that. But now she's getting to the point where she's going to be out there in the real world. And it just breaks my heart.
Yeah.
Really. And, you know, what can we do about it? Nothing. I mean, all I can do is just keep telling her how beautiful she is, you know, but, and she's an awesome sister, and the two little girls, they don't, you know, they don't think anything of the fact that they're all different, you know, they're all different, every one of them, you know, and we go from blonde hair and blue eyes to dark,
and
from the same family, you know, and it's just, you know, it's just pathetic.
There was an interesting piece on Alternet a while back. I had it in my stack. In fact, I'm going through papers right now as we talk, looking for it, and that I've been meaning to bring up all week and get into a conversation about, but I just haven't had the moment hasn't occurred, and maybe this is the moment. Oh, here it is. It was on TPM, and although it might be an AP article. It was from TPM Cafe, opinion piece, and by Chuck Burton. And the headline was, "Until we tackle segregation, white cops will keep shooting black people." And his argument was that, you know, going back to starting with slave patrols and then black codes and then lynching and then convict leasing and, you know, on and on and on. We have this long history, and it's continuing as a large part as a consequence of segregation. And we are in the process now and have been for the better part of 20 years of resegregating as a nation, voluntarily resegregating as a nation. And Karen Hunter and I were talking about this on her radio show on Sirius the other day. I don't know what to do about this. And because I really believe that, you know, living side by side, getting to know each other, having our kids in the same schools, all that kind of thing, is probably a really good thing and probably part of the solution to all this. On the other hand, you know, there is some reality to the idea that when the dominant, male-dominated, patriarchal white culture of the white Christian culture that controls this country reaches out to minority groups, whether they be African-American or Native American or immigrants or frankly, you know, in some of our efforts in other countries, when we reach out to them and say, yeah, you know, you can become like us, that's really the velvet glove over the iron fist of cultural tyranny. Because what we're saying is, you will become like us. You know, we are not taking your culture seriously. And there's a long history in the United States of black culture, as you know, that is, you know, in some very relatively clear ways, somewhat different from mainstream white culture in the United States. And so, you know, how do we do that? Are we looking, you know, I don't have any answer for it. Do you, Susan?
I think it's my opinion that, well, when this relationship started, our family lost friends. Our family lost
between your white son and his multiracial wife.
Right. Yes.
You lost friends and family over this?
Well, my son-in-law, who would be the girl's grandfather,
right.
His family is, they've stopped inviting my daughter and son-in-law to family gatherings because they might bring the little black girl. And
now you're not talking about 20 years ago. You're talking about now.
No. Yeah, my great granddaughter's only 8, and the other two are 3 and 5.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're talking now.
Yeah.
You know.
What part of Ohio? Wooster, Ohio is northwestern Ohio, isn't it? Or northeastern? I mean.
We're about 60 miles south of Cleveland and 60 miles north of Columbus.
Right, and maybe 100 miles west of West Virginia, if I'm remembering my geography right.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but,
I mean, that's kind of there's a swatch of kind of coal country, white redneck, mm-hmm. you know, that goes through that area. That's amazing. Well, Susan, thank you for sharing your story with me. I appreciate it, but I'm guessing a lot of our viewers got even more out of it. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thank you for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. You can drop by our free live chat room and drop in and say hi. It's free. It's fun. It's the coolest chat on earth. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. My computer reset itself again. So I'm getting into the chat room myself right now. So while that is happening, let's pick up a phone call here. Jim in Gainesville, Florida. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
Tom, I was watching the Senate debate, or I'm sorry, the House debate yesterday of the repeal of the estate tax.
Right.
And, of course, this is a tax that's only imposed on a very small sliver of the super wealthy in
right.
the United States. And the Republicans, of course, they like to demonize it and call it the death tax.
Right.
And the Republicans were using the same old tried and sorry argument that unless we repeal this tax, which raises $250 billion, that family farms are going to have to be broken up when the head of the family dies.
Right.
Well,
here's the problem with that, Jim. They can't find a family who has been hurt that way by the estate tax. If they could, they would trot them out and they'd be on TV and everybody, oh, we don't want to have what happened to the Johnson family happen to anybody else.
Well, Tom, what happened was Democratic Representative Jim McDermott from Washington State countered the argument and said, look, if you don't have an estate of $5 million, you don't have to pay any estate tax.
Correct.
And
for an individual or $10 million for a couple.
And if you have a family-owned business, the estate tax can be paid in 5 installments and deferred for 10 years before you have to make the first installment.
Well, not only that, with estate planning, there's a million ways to get around that with a business. You start distributing shares of the business. You change the type of corporation it is. You start distributing shares to your children. You put things in trust. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to avoid paying an estate tax for frankly, everything from a small or medium-sized business, you know, $5 or $10 million business, all the way up to a multi-billion-dollar business like Koch Industries or the Walmart heirs actually are the ones who secretly funded the, I believe it was a several $100 million effort over a number of years to change in the popular lexicon the phrase estate tax into the phrase death tax. They promoted that originally, and they got busted. They got outed on that. But that's what's going on. The estate tax was first put into place in the United States in 1797. It was the first estate tax. It was brought back by Teddy Roosevelt. And the whole idea of the estate tax in the 1900s, the whole idea of the estate tax was not so much to raise tax revenue, although, as you said, it does. It'll raise $280 billion over a 10-year period. The cost of public tuition at every state university in the United States, every single student, is only $61 billion a year. So, you know, the estate tax itself would pay for a little more than 2 years of college for every American. You know, and that's with a really, really low estate tax. And frankly, I think it should be raised. I think that after $1 billion, now keep in mind how much money $1 billion is. After $1 billion, the estate tax should be 100%. If somebody can't live on $1 billion, they've got a serious problem. Physical, psychological, I don't know what it is, but they got a moral, they got a serious problem. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, and thanks for bringing up the topic. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And Roy in Greensboro, North Carolina. Hey, Roy, what's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to call and clue you in on something you may not be aware of. Everybody knows about the obvious conservative control of the media with Clear Channel and conservative talk shows everywhere, even though when the marketplace they get ratings of next to nothing, they're supported by a lot of conservative advertisers. But there's something I think a lot of people aren't aware of, and that is there's a group called the Educational Media Foundation. You ever heard of them?
Not that I can pull out of my memory right now. Maybe if you keep talking, it'll spark something.
Okay, well, the big thing that most people know about is their religious nonprofit stations under the banner of K-Love and Air One. That's their public face.
Right.
Their private face is they have other smaller shell corporations that have been going around the country buying up radio stations left and right and running them as commercial stations. Commercial stations that strictly control what gets played on the air. Want to record a protest song? Forget it. It's not going to get played on an EMF station. Only stuff that they approve of will air on these regular commercial radio stations playing regular secular music in all kinds of formats.
Well, that's the right and privilege of a for-profit corporation. I mean, the issue that you're raising isn't so much one of corporate governance as it is an issue of the commons, the media commons and our media infrastructure, and how to most appropriately small d democratize it.
They've been doing this very quietly under the radar, running both a nonprofit and a profit at the same time, which I know they can do.
Right.
But they've been quietly amassing control of stations all over the country that people just aren't aware of because they've been doing it under the radar. It's not.
Are they running religious broadcasting on these programs? Are they running religious broadcasting? Because that's another giant industry. I mean, Pat Robertson sold his religious broadcasting empire for $1 billion. That's astonishing.
Well, all of the nonprofit stations are all religious stations.
Right.
The K-Love and Air One and so forth all around the country. You'll see the bumper stickers all over the country.
Right.
They're also running thousands and thousands of translators all over the country, which is another subject entirely.
Right.
But their for-profit arm are running commercial radio stations with the same mission as the religious stations, only disguised as a standard commercial radio station in the content and how they control the messaging and so forth. And
fascinating.
So forth.
I have to admit, Roy, I'm familiar sort of. I mean, back in the 80s, actually, I went to an NLRB conference here in Washington, D.C., National Religious Broadcasters Association. It's not NLRB. It's National NRBA, I guess it is. And was astonished at the scope, breadth, and power of the Christian radio industry. I mean, it's an industry. It's a multi hundred million, maybe a multi-billion-dollar industry. There's a massive amount of money that's being made by these radio preachers who go on the air and then beg for money on the air. And there's a whole business model associated with it. They try out different stations. They buy the airtime. If they make more in donations than it costs them, they continue. If they lose, then they drop that station and move on to another one. It's a business. It's amazing. Roy, I got to move along, but thanks for the call. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Just to tag on the last caller's comment, my older brother, who's he's a fundamentalist evangelical, has been for about 35 years. He went to a Bible college down in somewhere in Oklahoma. This was a number of years ago to study to be a televangelist. And I got to tell you, he dropped out of it in the first couple of months because it was even too slimy for him.
Yeah.
In terms of what they were asking, it was all about money.
Oh yeah.
And he said, I just couldn't even do that. But
the other thing I don't think most people know about Salem Broadcasting, which is I believe funded by their Bible publishing arm, and they've got Dennis Prager and Michael Medved and all these guys on, and they've got stations all over the country, and again it's hardcore right wing radio with a heavily Christian, heavily pro Israel tilt, and it's very interesting.
Some observations about Hillary Clinton.
Sir
Tom, if I was saying to Daniel, the catty misogyny really is coming from, it seems to me, the Republican women. The men have kind of laid off, and the Republican women I've really teed off on Hillary Clinton in very misogynistic ways.
You're talking about this woman who just referred to her as Ovary Clinton?
Yeah, oh, yeah, and then the drowning in estrogen, and then a Carly Fioroni or whatever her name is.
Fiorina,
I call her Carly Fioroni, the San Francisco tree. But she's just does nothing but attack in the most vicious ways. But what disturbs me is that Democrats are kind of buying into that. And, I mean, Democrats, with regard to Hillary Clinton, are letting the perfect be the enemy of the best. And what I mean by the best is she's what we have right now. I like Bernie Sanders and I like Elizabeth Warren, but they're not running. And in terms of Hillary Clinton being a corporatist and a war hawk, okay, listen, you don't have to be Franklin Roosevelt for me to support her. And Franklin Roosevelt, Hillary Clinton, in terms of riches, has got nothing on Franklin Roosevelt. Another thing, one of our greatest chief justices of the Supreme Court, Charles Evan Hughes, from the 1930s, was a corporate lawyer.
Right.
He was the first appointed to the court in 1910 by William Howard Taft. But he turned out to be – he was the one who wrote the opinion to uphold the minimum wage, to establish the minimum wage.
Right.
So because of the you happen to be a corporate – this doesn't mean that you will necessarily be – in the pockets of the corporations. And another point is that Howard Zinn, in the last chapter of his book, The People's History of the United States, pointed out the function of the president has become, and I can't quote it, I don't have it in front of me, but to be able to bring together large forces like corporations and so on. So you have to be able to talk to them. You can't just spit in their eye like a lot of people, Democrats, because we ran this Republican-like campaign in 2014.
Right.
We are
altogether too quick to form the circular firing squad, Paul. I'm with you, and I'm not going to do it on this program. You know, that said, I would love to see Bernie or Elizabeth or whatever, but, you know, Paul, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And check out greenworldrising.org for our new video with Leonardo DiCaprio. Fair and only slightly unbalanced, Tom Harbin here with you. Welcome back. Oh, what a beautiful day it is, indeed. Anything goes Friday here on the Tom Harbin program. Catherine in Monterey, California. Hey, Catherine, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for the program today, especially the chat with Bernie.
Sure.
I wonder if you've heard, there was an article in Mother Jones recently about a new push by some large retail chains to do away with their obligations under workman's comp.
Were they arguing for self-insurance?
Well, see, there's already Texas and Oklahoma already have opted out.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these big retailers, Walmart, even Nordstrom, Safeway, Lowe's, are under the umbrella of a lobby firm called ARAWC, which stands for Association of Retailers Against Workmen's Comp. And so these big retailers are looking to lobby their local, you know, their state governments to do away with the requirements for participating in the regular workman's comp program.
Wow.
And the article in Mother Jones details how this has impacted claimants in the states that already have this, Texas and Oklahoma.
People who have been injured on the job and no longer can get compensation for their injuries.
Yeah, and they have to do an arbitration, and the company gets to appoint their own arbitrator, and a lot of different negative results for the employees.
Yeah, and arbitration is the big new fad. What it does is it basically says when you sign a contract that says that this will go to arbitration if there's a dispute, what you are signing away is your Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendment rights under the Constitution of the United States. You are signing away your right to sue. And your literally your constitutional rights. Fascinating stuff. Catherine, thanks for sharing it with us. I appreciate the call. Kathy in Cambridge, Ohio. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. And
sure.
I can't tell you how frequently listening to you helps hold body, soul, and sanity together.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. Many of the calls today have touched me very deeply. For the woman from Worcester, from Bernie himself, Senator Sanders, on so many levels that it's hard for me to narrow this down, but I'm going to make every effort to.
Mm-hmm.
I am a wife, a mother, a grandmother. I am the least educated of my numerous cousins, many of whom, most of whom have their doctorates, at least their master's.
Mm-hmm.
I'm self-educated. And so it was refreshing to me when you referred to persons whom you have hired who may or may not have a degree, and it was their passion and their desire to learn whatever was necessary for their advancement.
Yeah.
In this case, within your business. So I'm encouraged by that.
Yeah, I call it temperament. I've had this conversation. I used to be a member of a small business group down in Atlanta. It was a whole bunch of us who all own small businesses, and we get together once a month for dinner. In fact, I'm still a member. I get their emails every month, but I don't live in Atlanta anymore. And I helped start the group, actually. And this, I've had this conversation so many times with business people. Training, I mean, you know, obviously you don't want to hire somebody as a doctor who's never been to medical school, but training is not the big variable. The big variable is what I call temperament. It's the baseline personality of the person. Is this somebody who is really committed? Is this somebody who really cares? Is this somebody who has the potential, who has in them enthusiasm and passion? And then, you know, as a business owner, you know, the challenge is creating a business that people can be passionate about, you know, that people care about enough that they will commit themselves to it. And Louise and I have always tried to do that, to try and create a business where people are excited to work with us, where we have a mission statement that we're making the world better, even if we're making the world better by running an advertising agency or a travel agency, we're making the world better. And pardon me, Kathy, I'm rambling.
Not at all. It's music to my ears. Back when DIRT was invented and I was leaving high school, I considered joining the medical field and decided that emotionally I was, although I was probably intellectually fine for the challenge, I was not emotionally there yet.
Yeah.
And at that time it was the Vietnam era, and I was emotionally torn there, wanting to desperately support my peers who were serving and anyone in uniform who put themselves in harm's way for mine and everyone's benefit.
Mm.
I was juxtaposed to our being there and why we were there, and even at my young years, albeit I am not a normally the person who would be the first to storm the blockade.
Mm-hmm.
I am an observer by nature, but I will storm that blockade once I have assurance that that is the proper thing to do. That is the high ground.
Yeah, there you go.
And that's my problem now. The high ground is the emperors have no clothes in this country anymore.
Right.
And yet they are still there.
They're in power, but everybody has figured it out. We're sort of in that era just before the French Revolution. I just feel the air is like crackling. There are so many people in this country who are struggling so hard as a consequence of 35 years of Reaganomics. It is breathtaking. Kathy, thank you for the call. I've got to move along. Let some other folks get in here. But Kathy, thanks for the points you brought up. Linda in Belmont, Illinois. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I live here in southern Illinois in a little village where oil and corn are king, you know.
Mm.
But I'm trying to get an ordinance passed where it's like banning the burning of plastic and couches and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And people have tried before me, and it hasn't done any good. So what I did was I called the EPA trying to get that. I wanted them to come to our next board meeting where I, you know, wrote a thing up about trying to get it passed and the health concerns and the environmental concerns of doing that. And they said they couldn't because there's one field agent for 22 counties
And that is crazy.
Yeah. Here's a tip, Linda. Stop talking about burning and start talking about poisoning.
Okay.
Say, you know, we don't want to be poisoned anymore by using burning as a way to dispose of flame retardant laced furniture, for example. You know, we don't want to be poisoned anymore by plastics being burned in open pits, and then we inhale the carcinogenic fumes. And if you start putting it in that frame, in that context, I think you'll find your local support may start increasing.
I don't think it will, because there's like, we have 300 people in this town, so it's really small.
Hmm.
And so they knew who called, you know, you have to tell them.
I see.
So now, then the woman, because, you know, it is a rural area, she told him that, because our town does it too, they have a place where the people can bring their limbs and stuff.
Sure.
And they burn those, but people put mattresses and couches and all that in there, and they were, in the past, burning that as long with the limbs.
Yeah.
Well, she told him that as long as they pulled that stuff out, that they couldn't burn that stuff, they had to pull it out, and he said they always burned it out. So now he's mad at me, and he's put a big sign up at the village meeting place, those reader boards,
yeah,
saying that they have to close the whole thing down due to the EPA, and that's not what the woman had said.
Yeah.
So now everybody's going to be mad at me, which I really don't care, but I mean...
Well, you do care, Linda, and, you know, nobody likes everybody being mad at them, but, you know, this is... Small-town politics are really rough. We lived in a small town in Vermont years ago. From 97 to 2001, and then we moved into Montpelier, which is 7,000 people. It's still a small town, but the little town we lived in before that had maybe, you know, there was one street that went through the middle of it. There was no street light, and there were maybe 40 houses on either side of the street. That was the town. I don't know the exact population, but it was probably fewer than 300. And about a third of the houses had cars on blocks in their front yards. I mean, this is a poor part of rural Vermont. And but because it was close enough to Montpelier, you had some basically, you know, bedroom community yuppies moving in who were buying houses in this little town and working in Montpelier and concerned about the appearance. And so they got together with the city council and they passed an ordinance saying that if you had a car on blocks in your front yard, you got hit with a $25 fine. And so the folks in town were offended by this, and so they held in the next city council election, the pro-junk car faction ran and won, and they passed an ordinance that said that if you didn't have a junked car in your front yard, you had to pay a $50 fine. And so it's like, that was about the time we moved out of town. But I get it, how small town politics work and how it breaks people up and they get all bitter and divisive. And I don't know what to advise you other than, patience and equanimity.
And he was like, "Well, I'm going to try to." He said, "I'm going to get you. I'm going to do everything I can against you. So I guess I'm going to have a hard road to tow."
Yeah.
But I'm just going to stick to my guns and be nice about everything.
Well, good luck, Linda. I wish you the very best. Thanks a lot for the call. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And to check out our newest video, it's called Restoration, narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio. Go to GreenWorldRising.org. Welcome back. Odell in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Odell, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Look, give me 78 seconds. Here I go.
You got it.
Okay. All right. No unions? No pension. All right. Europe, the land, Caucasian. Caucasian, that's their origin. Not Africa, not Asia, not North America. All right. Hannibal, from Africa, college. Went over there, down to Sicily. I'd like to know how a white man with a white woman can make a mulatto baby. Now, Hannibal. New Compact Bible Dictionary. Progenitor of the dark race. Ethiopians, Libyans, Egyptians, Canaanites. Now, Bathsheba, Bathsheba married Solomon, married David, King David, four sons. Solomon's bloodline is with Joseph, legal father of Jesus. Nathan goes all the way to Mary, the mother of Jesus. Now, God sent this people into slavery. So, I'm done. I thank you. You got a comment? I'll listen. If not, I...
Okay. Thank you. Odell, thank you. Thank you for the call. I'm not sure what to say to that. It's fascinating stuff. Thank you. Rick in Woodland Hills, California. Hey, Rick, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Oh, I heard yesterday that you mentioned about the disintegration of the Republican Party. It was falling apart, and I didn't get the call on it. But it reminded me of a Carville quote. If GOP loses against Hillary, the Republican Party will be extinct. She said that to Laura Ingraham a year or so ago.
Who said that? James Carville?
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, I think especially interesting now that Hillary is in the race.
Well, they view her as mortal enemy number one because her husband is so popular. And she's quite popular. And you know, the women of America are starting to pay attention to this presidential race. And that's a good thing in my mind.
Yeah, that is. Well, you know, I've done some research on the demise of the way it went the way of the Whigs, and it was about an equality issue that really came up. Of course, it was not the obvious one was the slavery issue, but they were also the Know Nothing Party, which was part of that thing, kind of like analogous to the Tea Party.
Right.
Was also against what Irish and Italians.
Yeah, they ran Massachusetts and they ran much of Boston and the only jobs they would let the immigrant Irish have were police, which is where the whole copper thing came from and the whole Irish cop thing came from.
Right, right. Have you been looking at the parallel between what happened back there in the 1850s and what's happening now?
With regard to
with the Republic, yeah, with the Republican Party.
So, oh,
yeah.
Well, you know, no, I haven't. You know, it seems in my book, The Crash of 2016, I point out that the economic crash of 1856 set up the Civil War in many ways, just like the crash of 1929 set up World War II in many ways, and hopefully this crash won't set up a world war, but. With regard to the Republican Party, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see, Rick. It's a relatively recent party. It's only been around since the 1850s. So thanks a lot for the call. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the companies that syndicate this program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the great folks at RT and at Free Speech TV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, and to Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, our underwriters, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. You keep us on the air. Morris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, what's on your mind?
Yes, Professor, I wanted your permission to get a bumper sticker that says Republican voters are suckers, www.tomhartman.com. Are you good with that?
You don't need my permission. That's fine with me, Morris.
Okay, the other day I was listening to your interview with Ian Millhiser. I did read his book, Injustices, and many of the issues that we were experiencing, Professor, from the Civil War are still applicable today. You've got Justice Melvin Fuller, for example, who suggested that the 14th Amendment was unconstitutional. Then you've got Justice Campbell, Archibald Campbell, who pretty much that the Constitution was only applicable to the white race. And I'll tell you, sometimes it was safer to be a descendant of a slave than it was to be a union member back in those days.
Yeah.
But anyway, I really appreciated that interview. And also, I also appreciated your interview with Professor Cohen. Outstanding interview. And I appreciate the amount of time and respect that you give him. And I just wanted to say that to you. And thank you for taking my call.
Professor. Thank you, Morris. Thanks for your kind comments. We'll try to do more of it. Chuck in Mosier, Oregon. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Burger King?
I'm glad I could get through. Pardon?
Burger King? That's what it says in my call screen software here. You're calling about Burger King signs?
Oh, yeah. You remember the Burma Shave.
Oh, Burma Shave. Oh, yeah. You've got to be a certain age to remember those, where you'd be driving along
Well, there's a lot of us that age out there.
Yeah, I remember them well.
Going around the countryside.
But they pretty much vanished by earlier mid-60s? Seems to me like they were gone. You know, the Burma Shave signs were very much a piece of American landscape in the 40s and 50s.
Oh, yeah, and probably right in, depending on where you were, I remember seeing them right into the 60s in some places in upstate New York and around. But anyway, that'd be a great takeoff for people that actually, you could run that on the net, you could put that on, just liven it up a little bit. People that remember it could post signs like that or along their property.
Right.
Minimum wage, Social Security, women's rights,
right.
Abortion.
For people,
Democrat.
Chuck, people who are not of a certain age, I should explain what the Burma Shave ads were. You would be driving along, and there would be a series of three or four or five relatively small roadside signs. They didn't. My recollection is they didn't buy big billboards. They were more like campaign signs, you know, so and so for president, and they had sayings on them. And you know, if you want to have a happy day, and then the next sign would say smile every day, and then the next sign would say and be nice to everybody, and then the next sign would say Burma Shave. You know, only that wasn't one of the things that they said because they always rhymed or they were always cute, and I can't remember any of them. But if we were to have a series of signs, three or four signs, that had a specific and explicit political message, and then the very last one was, you know, vote Democratic or listen to the Tom Hartman program or whatever, I don't know, it's a possibility. Chuck, interesting idea. Thank you very much for the call. Akeem in St. Ann, Illinois. Hey, Akeem, thanks for watching Free Speech. What's up?
Just really wanted to thank you for your work. I've been listening to you since the age of like 13.
Wow.
Really been influential in my life.
Thank you.
I had a question about Reaganomics and its effects on social class. I have this English project that I'm doing for my last project before I graduate from high school. And I was wondering if you had any information that you could point me to, per se. I mean, the project as a whole is about me talking about social class and whether or not human society really needs social classes, and
right.
I'm focusing on the U.S.
Right. What you want to do is hit a bookstore and look for books by David K. Johnston. David. And it's K is C-A-Y, and I think Johnston with a T, J-O-H-N-S-T-O-N. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's how it's spelled. And he has written some absolutely brilliant books about the consequences of neoliberal economic policies, Reaganomics, essentially. And then there's another book called Tear Down This Myth by Will Bunch, and that is just a great deconstruction of all of the mythologies and lies and exaggerations that the Republican Party has spent hundreds of billions of dollars promoting over the years here in the United States about that. So does that help, Akeem?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Thank you.
Okay, good luck. I wish you the very best. Denise in Free Speech in Calumet, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Denise, we've got a 1 minute to the end of the show. It's all yours.
I was at the beautician's yesterday, and we were talking politics, and she agreed with everything I said, but then she said one thing that I thought, wow. She said, Denise, if Hillary is the only one that runs, there's so many Hillary lovers, but then there's the Hillary haters, and the Hillary haters could take us right down.
Could be. Could be. I think most of the Hillary haters, though, are not Democrats. I think they're Republicans, and they're not going to vote for any Democrat.
I hope so, because
the question is, will independent and Democratic, and I don't say liberal or progressive intentionally, but men who identify as Democrats and independents who occasionally vote as Democrats, will those men vote for Hillary Clinton? And that's the big question. You know, I think the odds are fairly high that the women will, but who knows? I mean, it's, you know, not everybody votes their race or their gender. In fact, I think probably most people vote more on the candidate than on those kind of variables. Denise, thanks for the call. Thank you very much. And thanks for being with us this week. It's been a great week. Fascinating stuff. Did you see Jeb put yesterday? Chris Christie came out and said, yeah, if I become president, I'm going to raise the retirement age. And then today, Jeb Bush came out and said, yeah, I'll do what Chris Christie did. We got to raise the retirement age. These guys are going to win on this? Really? Democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're in. See you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.